You're listening to Aloud, a program of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles.
Thank you so much for joining us tonight. I'm probably new to you. I'm Jen Dees. I'm the Library Foundation's production manager for public programs, and we're so glad you're joining us here. This is going to be a great night. Photojournalism is about reading human beings, according to Lindsay Addario, our featured guest. One of the most brilliant photojournalists working today and a winner of the Pulitzer Prize for International Reporting, Lindsay Addario's work has been featured in the New York Times, National Geographic, Time Magazine. Her work has borne witness to some of the most critical moments in our recent global and political history, from Afghanistan before and after 9/11, to Darfur in the aftermath of genocide, to Iraq following its invasion, and to Libya, where she was among four journalists abducted by loyalists to Gaddafi. Unbelievably, the second time she survived abduction. Her new book, Of Love and War, includes over 200 photographs taken over the past two decades, many documenting remarkable and resilient women like herself, living and working in the midst of political and cultural conflict. Lindsay is joined by Amanda de Cadenet, photographer, journalist, and founder of Girl Gaze, a global community of female-identifying photographers, directors, and creatives working to close the gender gap in their respective fields by pairing women with opportunities to step behind the camera. The youngest woman ever to shoot the cover of Vogue, Amanda has photographed and interviewed many of the most influential people of our time, including Hillary Clinton, and I hope we'll be able to tune into her new program, Now What, with Amanda de Cadenet on Showtime very soon. Both Lindsay and Amanda will be signing books in the lobby afterwards, so if you haven't snagged your copy, our bookseller, Francis, will love to help you out after the program. Thank you for being here, your presence, and your memberships. If you are a member of the Library Foundation, go to support the public programs of the library, as I'm sure you're aware, so thank you for that. And if you're interested in membership, we'd love to talk to you in the lobby afterwards. So thank you very much, and please help me to welcome Amanda and Lindsay.
I didn't know this program existed in Los Angeles. It's such a treat to be here and to spend the evening with you all and my dear friend Lindsay. Full disclosure, Lindsay is my friend, and I just like to say that up front. So I have heard her stories for many years, and I am still completely enchanted and fascinated by her in so many ways, and the work that she does, and the stories that she's sharing with us and the world. So it's a real honor for me to get to sit and ask you questions and be able to look at your images and share your stories with everyone. So as previously said, Lindsay has a new book out called Of Love and War, and it is a beautiful, stunning photography book that also contains a lot of her personal letters and Lindsay memorabilia from all of your years around the world. It's a stunning book, and I hope if any of you, you know, if you haven't seen it, it'll be around for you to see afterwards. So, as I said, I love hearing Lindsay's stories, and I thought one of the best ways for us to share those with you would be for her to sort of talk through some of the images that are probably Lindsay's best hits and really illustrate the stories that have, some of the most significant stories that she's brought to our attention through the different publications and, you know, places that she has traveled to. So I thought Lindsay could walk you through, and then what we'll do is at the end, if anyone has questions for Lindsay, we'll leave time for you to ask her those. So that's what I thought we would do.
Great. So a lot of people ask,
Lindsay Addario,
why I started covering war, and then they ask if I grew up in a violent family or
what's wrong with you?
And I thought I would start with this photo. I am the youngest of four sisters. And anyone who has older sisters knows it's the best training to be a war photographer ever. because they used to stick puffy stickers up my nose and beat me up. And so, yeah.
But who got the last laugh, right? Yeah.
So when I was putting this book together, I had millions of photos to look through. I had 23 years of photographs. And the beginning of the book were, I ended up putting in photos that sort of, I didn't know where to put in elsewhere. They didn't really flow with the rest of the book. So this is a series on juveniles in prison in Sierra Leone. And my first assignment for National Geographic magazine in Bhutan in 2007 and 8. And that assignment was gross national happiness, which for me was sort of very confusing because I had been covering war almost exclusively at that point.
What does that mean?
Exactly.
Can we just get some clarity on that? What does that mean, so gross national happiness?
So Bhutan's philosophy was gross national happiness. And so they had had a closed kingdom to the rest of the world. And they decided to start opening it up in the late 90s to foreigners and for the first time. And so they were experimenting with democracy. And so National Geographic sent me there to sort of explore the country. So this is from a drought in 2011 in the Horn of Africa. And Iraqis at a 5D cinema. So I had covered the war in Iraq in 2003 and 4, and then National Geographic sent me to go back to photograph sort of Baghdad's resurgence in 2009 and 10. And so I went to Al Mansour Park. That's a park. It was an amusement park that during the war, we used to go, a colleague and I used to go and ride the Ferris wheel at the height of the war just to sort of get away from everything. And so I went back there and found this theater. So in 2000, I was sort of finding my voice as a photographer. I was shooting a lot of black and white, a lot of film. Yep, panoramic camera, and working in India. I moved to India at that point, and I had a roommate who was going in and out of Afghanistan. And he said, you know, you should go to Afghanistan and photograph women because there are very few women working there. So I sort of said, okay, that's a great idea. I called
as
my sister.
You do.
Yes. I called my sister Lisa. I had no money in the bank, and I called Lisa and her husband Joe, and I said, can I borrow some money because I have no money to go to Afghanistan? Of course, no one asked what Afghanistan was and whether it was safe because no one knew. It was before September 11th, and they just wired me $2,000. And I called my mother and said, Mom, I'm going to Afghanistan tomorrow. And she said, okay, honey, have a good time. So these are some of those images. And photography was illegal under the Taliban, so I had to sneak around with my cameras in a bag and shoot sort of surreptitiously very quickly.
How did you do that? And what did you wear? Because I'm assuming you had to wear
I dressed
clothing.
Sort of like the teacher in this picture. So there were all forms of entertainment were illegal. Music was illegal. Girls going to school was illegal. Women couldn't work. And so I was a single woman going to Afghanistan. I needed literally a man to walk around with me everywhere just to leave the hotel. The Taliban had to provide me with a minder, so a man. The United Nations provided me with someone at some points. And so when I was with the UN, I was able to go visit some of these secret girls' schools, to go in. This is a women's hospital under the Taliban. There was no medicine, very few doctors. This is a woman in labor under the Taliban. But at that point, it was incredible because I made three trips to Afghanistan under the Taliban, and I was sort of learning how to photograph in a place where photography was illegal. I didn't really have the tools at that point. So I was sort of figuring out the boundaries. How do I do this? Do I, you know, because I was a woman, I realized I could access women in a way that my male colleagues couldn't, so I can go into people's homes. I could work in the women's hospitals.
I just want to ask, how did the women respond to seeing you?
Sure.
With a woman who clearly was there working with a camera when there was so many restrictions that they were living with. What was their response to you?
They were really grateful. They wanted the world to understand what was going on there. And ironically, because there was no Facebook, there was no social media, there was no internet, they weren't worried about me taking their picture because they knew it would never come back to Afghanistan. So I actually was able to shoot a lot more under the Taliban if I could actually get access to the people than now. People are much more paranoid because they know that all their relatives and friends will see their images on Facebook and all over. So in 2001, I was covering the drought. There was a drought in western Afghanistan. And the governor, actually, of Herat had given permission for journalists to go and photograph there because it was so bad. And my driver said,
"Madam, I have to leave early because one of my male relatives is getting married." And I said, "Great, take me to the wedding." And I was curious, like, what does a wedding look like under the Taliban? And so we walked down these very silent streets and descended, like, entered into this house. And they're huge compounds in Afghanistan, so every family has its own compound. And then we walked down the stairs, and the soundtrack of the Titanic was blasting.
Oh,
and
my
all
God.
These men and women were dancing around, and women unveiled with makeup and everything. So this was really my first experience understanding that life goes on even in a war and even in places that are the most oppressive. People find ways to be happy and to continue.
And to honor their ritual and their traditions.
Exactly,
right?
Exactly. So in 2001, after September 11th, I asked the New York Times if I can cover the fall of the Taliban, and they sent me into Kandahar. So this is the day the Taliban fell in Kandahar. We drove into the city. We were some of the first journalists to drive in, and I was so scared to get out of the car because this is the scene I saw. There were no women, of course. And I was working with Ruth Fremson, who was a New York Times photographer for the newspaper, and she just sort of jumped out of the car right into the sea of men. And I just looked, and I was like, okay, well, she can do it, I can do it. So I just jumped out after her.
Was it just the two of you women?
No, we were in a convoy. We were the only two women. I think Elizabeth Rubin was also there. I think there were about four women in total that I remember in that whole, in all of Kandahar at that time. The prisons, one thing that happens when a regime falls is that all these places that are routinely closed off to journalists suddenly open up. So intelligence offices, government offices, prisons. And so we were able to freely walk into this prison, found this man that had been in jail so long, he didn't even know the Taliban had come and gone from power.
Wow.
In 2003, I wanted to go cover the war in Iraq. I still had no combat experience, so instead of going in with the military, the 101st Airborne, where I was offered an embed position, I ended up going in through Iran into northern Iraq, where we thought there might be a humanitarian crisis of refugees fleeing north from Baghdad. And when we got there, there was this proxy war going on. So Kurdish Peshmerga, backed by American special forces, were fighting against Al-Ansar, which was a group linked to Al-Qaeda. So immediately I was thrown into these scenes of war that I wasn't really sure I can handle. It was the first time I was seeing dead bodies all over and fighting.
How did you handle that?
I mean, it depended on the situation. There was one day where we were, the U.S. had rained like, 24 cruise missiles on this village in the mountains in northern Iraq. And so we went in a convoy of journalists, and we wanted to see what the civilian casualties were and what the damage was. And so we started going toward the village, and there was a road that was blocked by people, and they said, "Don't come in, it's too dangerous." And so we were in probably four cars marked with TV, and it was Washington Post, New York Times, New York Times Magazine, and McClatchy. And so we were all just interviewing people as they fled the area and asking them what the situation was like, because that's how you have to do it if you can't get access. And everyone started warning us to leave. And I was shooting this truck of Peshmerga, they're Kurdish fighters, and I was photographing. And there was a cameraman named Paul, Australian, shooting next to me. And suddenly I got this feeling in my stomach, and I ran to the car and shut the door, and that car exploded.
Wow.
And the cameraman died. And I remember we didn't know if it was a mortar round, if we had been hit by a mortar or what. You don't really know what the incoming is at that moment. You have to wait and figure out what's happening. And so immediately we drove off, and we got to this school where they were bringing all the wounded. And I was standing there, and the guy, Paul's colleague, Eric, was in shock, and he was covered in blood. And he said, "Does anyone have a satellite phone?" And he was sort of talking into the air. And Elizabeth, my colleague, said, "You know, what number? I have a phone, what number?" And he just recites the number. And I'm standing there, sort of, I could barely hold myself together. And he says, he called the newsroom, and he said, "Hi, this is Eric. Paul is dead." And then he hung up. And I thought, I can't handle this. And so then at that moment, a taxi pulled up and said, "Is anyone here a journalist?" And I thought, oh, that's a great out. Like, I'll go deal with the taxi driver. So I went to the taxi, and I was like, "I'm a journalist." And he's like, "I have the body of a journalist in the trunk of my car."
And I doubled over and I just started crying and I ran to the back of the school because I was so embarrassed that I couldn't handle it. And I just thought, I want to leave. I don't want to be a war photographer. And then I realized I couldn't get out because I had no visa to go back through Iran and Saddam Hussein hadn't fallen yet. So I just had to stay. And then Saddam Hussein fell.
I mean, it's so interesting because when I hear you, and I, you know, describe, you know, your experiences for civilians like us, it's, you know, it's really unusual, Lindsay. I know that you're so used to it, but I have so many thoughts about, you know, safety and how do you get into these places, and you know, sure. It's gosh, I'm still so amazed by your stories, I have to say.
So, well, so Saddam Hussein fell like 6 weeks later. So we ended
you
up
you stayed
covering.
There until
we
then.
We stayed because there was no option. And then we saw these really incredible scenes of like, these are soldiers who had fought their way up from Kuwait all the way up to Tikrit. They're shaving and sort of cleaning up in front of one of Saddam's palaces. And then there's this is also at one of Saddam's palaces, and this is in Mosul. And Iraqis were so frustrated with Saddam when he was in power because he used to divert all the water in the country to make these personal lakes around his palaces. And no one had any running water in their homes. So when he fell, they all went swimming in his palaces and stole everything from his palaces. I mean, anything that wasn't nailed down was stolen. And it was like those scenes were unbelievable because you saw lines of Iraqis going into the palaces and everyone was coming out with stuff on their
heads
like ants. I mean, they were just walking around, you know, it was incredible. But then, of course, the war, the horrors of the war became unveiled. And this is a mass grave. So we went to the site of the actual grave. We watched them dig up the bodies. These are Shiites who were massacred by Saddam when he was in power, and none of them could mourn openly because it was prohibited. So when he fell, they went and dug up the bodies and pulled them out for the families to recover them to give them a proper burial. So each one of these white sheets is the body of someone, and if you look closely, there's writing on the sheets with descriptions, and so people would come and mourn. And there was looting that happened all across the country. So in 2003 and 4, there were so many explosions taking place. Iraqis were killing Iraqis. Iraqis were killing Americans. Americans were killing Iraqis. And as journalists, we sort of didn't have, you know, we just had to listen for the sound of explosions, literally run to the roof of the New York Times house, look for the smoke, and get in the car and drive there and hope we got there in time.
Wait, there was a house with New York Times journalists living together?
Yeah. There was a 9-bedroom compound where New York Times writers and photographers, security guards, cooks, we all live together.
I was going to ask you, how do you know where to go? And then you answer that.
But. So, well, a lot of that, our translators, like local journalists and drivers also, are very tapped in. So when things happen, they get phone calls, and immediately we try to figure out where to go. But on this particular day, we knew that there was a call for Iraqis to sign up for the police force. And those are always very dangerous because the insurgents always wanted to bomb them because they didn't want Iraqis to be police. So we heard that one of these calls were, one of these sort of job fairs, I guess it was bombed by two suicide bombers. And so we were too late to get to the site. It was cordoned off very quickly. So I went to the morgue to try and meet the families. And so when I went there, I was sitting on the sidewalk in front of the morgue with Hisham, who was my driver. And they were like family to us because we went everywhere with them and they protected us and they were amazing. And I was sitting next to the father and the father's brother. And they were crying and screaming. And they were waiting for a casket because so many Iraqis had been killed in that bombing that there weren't enough caskets in the city. So they were waiting for someone to bring a casket from somewhere else. And so the father was sitting next to me, cursing the Americans, saying, you know, the occupation and the Americans, and they're killing our people and our country's destroyed. And I turned to Hisham and said, don't you think we should tell him? And he was like, not really. And I said, well, so I said, you know, please tell him, you know, tell him I'm sorry. Tell him I'm so sorry about what happened and I'm American and I'm sorry. And so he stood up and he said, come with me. And he took me inside the morgue.
and he pulled his son down, and he opened the sheet, and he said, "This is what your country is doing. This is my son." He said, "I told my son not to sign up for the police because it would be bombed." He said, "I even took his car keys, and I hid my own." And at 6 o'clock that morning, his son found the keys and went to sign up, and he was killed.
What do you do with that grief?
I mean, that was really, really sad. I mean, I was crying when I was shooting that. Of course, when you see a father holding the body of his son and weeping, I mean, you know, these men are strong Arab men, and to watch them weep and to just, you know, beg you for answers, you know, that I don't have, of course. The only thing that I could do is tell his story. So then I started embedding with the military. So we would go in the middle of the
night. Does everyone know what embed means? Yes, okay, yes. Just checking.
So we would go in the middle of the night. They would round up Iraqis that they thought were insurgents, so against the American troops. They'd put bags on their heads and zip ties on their wrist. In 2004, I was invited to photograph the wounded soldiers coming out of Fallujah, and I was skeptical because at that point, I still hadn't really seen wounded American soldiers. It was something that the military, I think strategically, just didn't really let the media see.
This is the inside of an airplane, correct?
Yeah, this is the inside of a C-17 cargo aircraft. There were so many wounded coming out of Fallujah that they literally stripped the aircraft and put all the wounded on the floor. This is a young man who was wounded in Fallujah, and this is how he was literally being transported in a yellow school bus to the plane. And then they were all flown to Ramstein in Germany, where the U.S. had a big base and a very advanced hospital. And so I spent 5 days here. This is in Balad at the air base closest to Fallujah. And I sent the pictures to Life magazine. It was for Life magazine. And they held them for 5 months. And at the end of the 5 months, and I kept asking them, "What's happening with the story? It's so timely and no one has this access." And finally they said, the photo editor wrote, and she said, "I hate to tell you this, but we will never publish your pictures of wounded soldiers because my editor doesn't think the American public can handle them." So, of course, I got furious, and I said, "How dare you send me to war if you don't have the guts to publish what I shoot?" But then I called the New York Times Magazine. I called Kathy Ryan, who I still work with. 18 years I've been working with her, and she put them in the next issue of the magazine. In December 1st, 2009, I was doing an embed with the medevacs. The medevacs are the soldiers who go in and pick up the wounded from battle and bring them back to the hospital. And so we got a call for an alpha. That's the most gravely wounded. You have seconds to respond. It means someone is on the brink of dying. So everything is through night vision goggles, which is very difficult to navigate because there's no depth perception. Mm. It's pitch black. I have my cameras. I jump in the helicopter. And the flight was 3 minutes from takeoff to touchdown. We touch down, and this young man is put on the ground wrapped in a carpet in front of me. And I'm trying to figure out what was happening. I mean, it was very, I couldn't really understand sort of, was he alive? Was he dead? What had happened? And so this is one of the first shots I shot. Then we flew back to the sort of field hospital. And it was an unbelievable scene. All the Navy medics were ready for him. They knew that an alpha had been called. And they put him on the table, and for 29 minutes, they tried to save his life. They gave him blood. He lost 9 pints of blood. They opened his chest, massaged his heart. At some point, sort of, I was standing here the whole time. I didn't move. The sound of my shutter was so loud and so intrusive. I was trying to shoot, like, very, very little. And then an officer came over and said, "Stop taking pictures." And everyone in the room stopped and said, "No, she needs to be here, and Americans need to see this." And so he sort of backed off, and I continued shooting. At the end of 29 minutes, he died. And they pulled out a flag, and I had never seen this entire process. And everyone gathered around and said a prayer for him. And I remember thinking in that moment that his family didn't even know that their son had died. I knew before they did, which seemed so unfair.
But it is beautiful to see his colleagues honoring him, because we hear so often about fatalities and, you know, we hear about so many of them.
Sure.
And yet to see people there honoring him and...
Sure, because the military actually doesn't really tell the families anything. So what happened after this is that the Marines, the public affairs officers, approached me and they said, "You can't publish anything, any images that show the identity of the soldier, any revealing marks, any tattoos, until the family has been notified. And so...
How long before they notify them,
well,
generally?
So there's no... The family, I think it's a few days. I don't know, or maybe the next day. I don't know exactly how long, but we're not allowed to call the family. So what happens is the you have to give your phone number to the public affairs officers of the Marines, and then you hope that they call you. And if they don't call you, that means they don't want the picture published. And so on December 17th, so more than 2 weeks later, I was flying from India, where I was living, back to the U.S. for Christmas, and I landed to a voicemail from the father. And he said, I'm Jonathan Taylor's father, and I understand you were with my son when he died. Can you call me? And I remember I was shaking, and I went to a quiet place, and I called the father back, and he said, the only thing I know about my son is that he was killed in combat operations in Afghanistan. He said, can you tell me every single thing you remember from the minute you picked him up until he died? And I said, you know, I don't, how much detail do you want? Because it was very difficult, you know. And he said, I want to know everything. I want to be with my son every single moment. And so we had a very emotional talk that lasted about 2 hours. And he wanted to know if the medics did everything they could, if he was in good hands, if he was in pain. And I assured him he was not, and that he got the best treatment. And then at the end, he said, I have to talk to Jonathan's mother. He was divorced and he's remarried, and we'll let you know. And they, in the end, they came back about 6 weeks later and said that they didn't think the other siblings could handle it because Jonathan had two sisters. And so they asked us not to reveal the name of who was in this photo. And so Time Magazine respected their wishes, and we did a spread that didn't show any revealing, didn't show the face with this picture, but no name. And it wasn't until last year that the two sisters realized this was their brother.
Wow. How do you know they knew?
Because I'm in touch with the father. I've been in touch with the father since 2009. We've spoken at Veterans Conference together of suicidal veterans. We gave a presentation. He allowed me to show all of the pictures of his son to the veterans. And we talked about what it was like for him to receive the news and what it was like for me to be there and our relationship. And then last year, it was Veterans Day, and I always do a tribute to veterans on Veterans Day. And I put the name without thinking. I mean, 10 years had gone by. And he emailed me, and he said, my daughters follow you on Instagram. And they didn't.
Damn,
which, of course,
Instagram.
Is like the last thing I was thinking. And he said, it's okay. You know, enough time has passed, but I want you to know that. Could you please write a personal email to my daughters? And I said, of course. And so I wrote them, and they wrote back. But it was my mistake. So in 2007, I was working with Elizabeth Rubin for the New York Times Magazine. She wanted to know why so many civilians were dying in Afghanistan if we had some of the best technology in the world. So we asked to go into the most dangerous place in Afghanistan at the time. It was where the U.S. was dropping the most bombs in the country, and it was the Korangal Valley. So we went to the public affairs officer and said, you know, hey, we'd like to go to the Korangal Valley. And they said, looked at us up and down. We were both. Elizabeth was a little taller than I am. She's about 5'4", but I'm 5'1". And they said, you know, it's not really a place that's fit for women. And we were like, well, why not? And they said, well, there's no place for you to sleep and no place for you to go to the bathroom. We said, well, great. Where do the men sleep and where do the men go to the bathroom? And they said, they sleep in bunkers on the side of the mountain. We said, well, we can handle that. They said, okay, come back tomorrow. So we went back. They flew us out. We spent 2 months living on the side of the mountain with these guys, the 173rd Airborne. We went on 6-7-hour-a-day patrols, 7,000 feet in the mountains. And these are some of the sort of typical patrols we went on. At the end, we were airlifted onto the side of a mountain in the heart of the insurgency, jumped out in the middle of the night vision goggles, and walked for 6 days with everything on our back. Often, as a photographer, the most frustrating thing is being in these situations where we were with Captain Kearney, who is the commander. He's calling in for air support to try and bomb insurgents that he knew were armed and walking near us. And as a photographer, you can hear all the conversation going on, but there's nothing to photograph because everything's dark. Finally, I fell asleep in the middle of this entire exchange. I just sort of put my head back and fell asleep with my flak jacket and helmet. And Kearney
wakes me up and says, "Adario, we're sparkling." And I put on my night vision and I put my camera up to my face, took a picture, and I was like, "What is that?" So what you're looking at is, this is a JTAC. He's with the Air Force, and his job is to literally sparkle a target with a, this is a laser that's visible only through night vision goggles. So the AC-130 attack pilot can see where to drop the bomb. So he has coordinates, but he's also literally leading him onto a site. So I took this picture and then I fell back asleep.
As you do.
And this is where I slept. This is where we all slept in this ditch for the first three nights. So it was so cold. We were spooning. There were 11 of us, literally like sardines, because it was freezing. And then we were ambushed on the sixth day. And so in the book, this is Clenard. He's on the left, and he's carrying the body of Sergeant Rugel, who was killed, and that was his best friend. And I'm still in touch with Clenard. And so for my photo book, I asked Clenard if he would write something. And he said he felt more comfortable being interviewed. So I posed him a series of questions about what it was like for him that day. So that interview is in the book. And then a year later, we went directly on the other side of that valley to meet with the Taliban. I was working with Dexter Filkins for the New York Times Magazine. So as we were going to meet the Taliban, the commander said, "The only thing you can't do is bring a woman." So Dexter and I were sort of like, well, we're not separating. And Halim, who was our translator, very sympathetic to the Taliban, was like, "Oh, madam, Miss Lindsay, can't you give Mr. Dexter your camera?" No, it's not the way it works for the New York Times. So
it's not the way it works for you.
Yeah, not the way it works.
Yeah.
So he suggested we were husband and wife, that no Taliban would leave his wife alone in a strange village. So we said, great, we're husband and wife. We don't really care, so long as we can go together. So that's what we did. And we went and met Haji Namdar and were able to cover the Taliban.
How about when you went into the house?
Oh, you know my story.
I know, but I love this one.
So we went in to meet the Taliban, and there was a small room full of these guys. There were about 15 fighters. It was a tiny room, and it was very awkward because women in that part of the world don't leave the house. But it's also like one of the most hospitable places in the world. So if a Pashtun, which is the tribe that most of the Taliban are from, if they invite you to their home, it's upon their honor to make sure you're safe and they take care of you. They give you tea, they give you lunch, and so when you put a woman into that equation, it's
you
very awkward.
Fully
I was fully, fully veiled. You couldn't see any
other
part of my body.
Yeah, and you
I
had your like, camera underneath.
Yes. And so
I just want to give the visual because, you know.
So I walk in behind Dexter and I sit down.
Your husband.
Sort of, my husband. Yeah. And I sit down next to him and sort of just sitting there. And Dexter says, "Hey, man, Dexter Filkins was with the New York Times Magazine. Now he's with the New Yorker. But he calls everybody man." She's like, "Hey, man. Thanks, Haji Namdar, for letting my wife come. And, you know, my wife happens to have a camera. You mind if she takes some pictures?" And I just thought, there's no way that they'll believe. So, yes, okay, no problem. So I start shooting through my veil, and I dropped a lens. So I said, okay, forget it. I'm going to open a little slit here for my eyes. So I'm shooting. And then everyone in the room gets really fidgety. And I thought, oh, yeah, of course, this is where they kill us. We're meeting the Taliban. We're worth, like, $25 million each. This is insane. So the guy comes over, one man comes over, and he says, "Madam, we would like to serve you tea, but we don't know how you can drink the tea through your veil. Please, madam, we must serve you tea, so can you please go to the corner of the room, face the wall, lift your veil, drink your tea, and come back."
See, I love that story. Yeah.
So this is before Malala Yousafzai was shot. And so I had heard that they were closing down girls' schools in Swat Valley, where she's from. And I snuck in as my driver Raza's wife this time and was able to go to some of the secret girls' schools. There's a benefit to being a woman, I'd say.
Lots of them.
To being a wife.
And a wife, yeah.
This is a man who said he wanted to go fight jihad and kill Americans. So obviously, it's strange standing face to face with a man who says he wants all Americans dead. This is before the Pentagon lifted the ban on women in the military on the front lines of war. I started doing embeds with women on the front lines of war. Female engagement teams were a way the Marines used to engage Afghan women, 50% of the population, to win over hearts and minds. So they were able to find sort of a loophole in the ban of women on the front lines by sending women attached to male infantry. But of course, they were right where the men were. So this is in 2009. These are Afghan women getting trained to be police in Kabul.
We don't have that much time.
I know. That's a good story, too, but we don't have that we much time. Okay.
So that's a... Sorry, that is a maternal mortality story I was working on, and the woman on the right was in labor. I ended up taking her to the hospital to deliver safely. In
that
2004,
is the cover of your book.
This is the cover of the book. In 2004, I made my first trip to Africa and my first trip to Darfur, and it was to cover what eventually became a genocide in Darfur. And we snuck in. We couldn't get visas, so we had to go to Chad and walk in. To Darfur, we met up with these rebels with the Sudanese Liberation Army, and they piled about 17 of us on the back of one pickup truck, and we drove around the desert for 5 days in that truck. Every 15 minutes or, I don't know, every hour at maximum, the truck would break down, a sandstorm would come, we'd sit there, and so this was in one of those moments. And so in those 5 days, we saw villages that were bombed by the government. Men on horseback would come in and then burn the villages again so people couldn't claim anything. There were bodies all over the desert. People displaced, and then they'd try to make their way to neighboring Chad. And it was the first time a woman admitted to me of being raped as a weapon of war. This was in 2004, and I continue doing that work in the Democratic Republic of Congo. This is a woman who was given, who was HIV positive as a result of her rape. And this woman was enslaved for 6 years. She was abducted and enslaved, and these two children were born out of rape. And this is Ayak. She's South Sudanese. She was raped and impregnated with her perpetrator's child. And this is at a safe house in Uganda, where I met her with Aaron Baker for Time magazine, and we spent 3 days together with another woman also who had been raped and was impregnated. And this woman had gout, so she couldn't run when her village was attacked. And so she didn't feel comfortable showing her face, so I photographed her feet. So every sensitive story I do, I leave it up to the woman how she wants to be photographed or he wants to be photographed. They can choose to show their face. They cannot. It's completely up to them. And I usually also have a counselor present because if they're traumatized, it's important to get a second opinion. So that it's a real sort of team effort. And this is more of the maternal mortality work. In 2009, when I started doing maternal mortality, over 500,000 women were dying every year in childbirth. So I started documenting that in Sierra Leone, Afghanistan, India, all over, actually. And I've continued doing that work. I do about one story a year. I just came back from northern Nigeria, where I was working on that in Boko Haram territory. This is Mama Cisse. She was pregnant with twins. The first, she delivered the first twin in the village, and the second baby wouldn't come out. So she took a canoe across a river to an ambulance for 6 hours to the hospital where I met her. And we talked for about an hour while she was in labor with the second baby. She had been in school and happy. Her father pulled her out to get married and have children. She was terrified and exhausted, and she finally delivered the second baby. It was completely unresponsive, so while all the midwives were focused on resuscitating the baby, Mama Cisse started bleeding. And I kept saying, she's bleeding, and they said, no, she's fine, and that's her sister propping her up. Her sister was a midwife. So finally, I was uncomfortable. It didn't feel right. I'm not a doctor, but it just didn't feel right. So I said, where's the doctor? And they sort of laughed and said, there's one doctor in the whole province. And so I went to the surgical ward, and he was in there. And I put on scrubs, and I went into surgery and said, like, I think there's a woman dying. And he just looked at me and was like, I'm a little busy. So then I went back and said, well, I don't know. Why don't you take her blood pressure? And it was 60 over 30. And so they picked her up, and they brought her to the doctor. And she died. And this is Mama Cisse's funeral. So in 2011, I was covering the Arab Spring in Libya because I had missed the Arab Spring in Egypt, and it was such an important historical time in the Middle East, a region that I had been covering for so long, that I begged to go to Libya. The only way to get in was to go through neighboring Egypt. Often that's the case. Governments don't want journalists there showing what's happening. This was a popular uprising, so we snuck in through Egypt. There was a call to arms. Doctors, teachers, engineers volunteered to go fight against Gaddafi's troops. For 2 weeks, I worked on the front line. It was very, very heavy combat. We'd hear the hum of an aircraft. A bomb would land right next to us. There were wounded and dead almost every single day. March 15th, 2011, we were working in Ajdabiya, It was a town on the front line. Gaddafi's troops were pushing from the west, and the rebels we were with were pushing east. And I was working with three colleagues for the New York Times. And in that situation, it's very hard to, you have to make a judgment call. How long do you stay before you're overrun by Gaddafi's troops in that case? We knew the city would fall. The government was dropping leaflets down saying, if you're a civilian, leave. There were civilians fleeing en masse. Mortar rounds were walking onto our position. We all were experienced in war. We all knew the city would fall. By the time we decided to go east toward Benghazi, we ran directly into one of Gaddafi's checkpoints. And our driver panicked and jumped out of the car and said, we're journalists. The male colleagues were pulled out of the car. The rebels that we had been with started opening fire on that checkpoint, of course, because they were Gaddafi's troops were the enemy. And we were caught in the middle of that. We all ran for cover to a police checkpoint booth over to the right, and we were able to make it. We never saw our driver alive again after that point. We were told to lie face down in the dirt. Each one of us had a gun put to our heads, and I remember looking up to the barrel of a gun thinking, okay, this is it, but obviously, what am I doing here in Libya at this moment? And I looked to my right. As I was sort of begging, saying, you know, please don't shoot, I looked to my right and all of my colleagues, all three of them, were also just begging. And they, at that moment, a commander came over and said, you can't kill them, they're American. So they tied us up. For me, they took my shoes off my feet, tied me up with my laces, my wrists behind my back, my feet together, picked me up and carried me away. Of course, for me, I assumed I would be raped because I had been covering women who had been raped for my whole career in war. For 6 days, we were held, beaten, groped, threatened with execution. We were kept together, which we were very, very lucky. We were put in prison. We were thrown into the back of a pickup truck, driven 6 hours under the hot sun in an open back truck. Every 45 minutes, we were sort of lynched and beaten. And before they can pull us out of the car would speed up and go to the next village. So we were released 6 days later.
That is a story unto itself. I mean, that is, you know.
That's a, we're yeah. Yeah. This is the cliff notes. So I've been covering a lot of refugees. For me, combat's never been the most interesting part of war, or for me as a photographer. It's always the people, the civilians, the women, the children. So I started covering Syrian refugees when the war in Syria started. I've been in and out of Syria about 4 times. All illegally without a visa. I can't get a visa to get in. These are Syrians going into Iraq. This is at the border with Turkey. This is Taima for Time magazine. We spent a year following Syrian refugees through pregnancy and through the birth of their
children.
This
is such a powerful story.
And this, we followed the babies through their first birthday. So we became very, very close with these families. And then I went on to the Mediterranean and did these rescue ships. I've done 5 trips on the Mediterranean, where the Italian Navy, the Belgian Navy, a private boat named MOAS, and Doctors Without Borders all rescue people at sea trying to make their way from Libya to Europe. And this is after one of the rescues. And many of these people have been tortured for months in Libya before they actually make it onto a boat. And many die at sea. This Sunday, I have a piece from Yemen. I was in Yemen the last 2 weeks in September, and covering the war and the famine that is it hasn't been announced there's a famine, but there are millions of people on the brink of famine. There's a very scientific equation for a famine. That's why I say that. There are displaced, thousands of displaced within Yemen, within northern Yemen, and who have been hit by airstrikes led by the Saudis and the Emiratis and our tax dollars. And these are just some pictures of me on assignment, so you can see sort of what I look like in the field. This is Fallujah, crossing illegally into Darfur. This is in the Korangal Valley. This is in southern Afghanistan, Korangal. I'm the little one.
That's what you were wearing when you were the wife in the room, right?
No. Oh. I wasn't even that. I was more like the first outfit.
Okay.
This is Libya just a few days before we were taken. And that's me 7 months pregnant in Gaza. And that's it.
Mm. Thank you so much. Thank you for sharing all of those powerful images and the stories behind them. I think we probably have about 10 minutes for some questions. So does anyone have anything they'd like to ask Lindsay?
How do you go on? How do you find any way of dealing with the things that you see?
Yeah, I mean, I think genetically I'm just a very happy person. I'm really positive and I'm always laughing. And I think people mistake that for being sort of not empathetic enough, but that's not it at all. It's just that I that's how I am as a person. So I'm always joking around. And I do that in the field. And I think one thing that maybe most of you could not even conceive of is that most of the people I'm photographing, the only way they get through their situations is by having a sense of humor. So Iraqis, the Sudanese, so many of the people that I'm with are funny and they're joking and they're making light of their situation because there's nothing else to do. So for me, it's really about channeling everything I see into the work and really trying to get people motivated to care and to make change.
As a journalist, how do you stay objective in covering, you know, conflict like this?
I mean, it's not like I don't have my own opinions. Obviously, I have very strong opinions, which have been formed over the years. But I think it's really important to not insert myself in the story. It's very important to give people a voice and to let them tell their own story and to let you as the readers judge or make sort of, you know, you guys have to decide how you feel about a situation. It's not really for me to put myself into anything. So the important thing is to try to get as many different sides of a story as I can. That's not always possible, especially now that journalists are targeted more than ever.
I heard you say yesterday on Madeline Brand's show that Libya was the worst place you've been to. I'm wondering, I didn't actually hear the answer so much yesterday, but I was wondering why that was, and maybe you already answered it, but how all this affects you, I know you're a positive person and you're very curious, but it just seems so overwhelming.
So Libya was the worst fighting that I had covered because primarily because of the terrain. It was totally flat. There was no place to hide. For example, in Afghanistan, there are caves, there are rocks, there are trees. You can, when the shooting starts, you can position yourself that you have a better chance to stay alive. But in Libya, it was literally just flat, open desert. So when helicopter gunships would come and spray the ground around us, we had nowhere to go. We just sort of prayed that a bomb wouldn't land on our head or we wouldn't get hit by a bullet. I think also the soldiers that we were with, they weren't really soldiers. They were just, it was a popular uprising. So none of them had fighting experience. So sometimes when the fighting got so bad, they would just get in their cars and leave. And the journalists were like the only ones on the front line. So it was like, you know, it was the most terrifying fighting that I had covered. How do I deal with it? I have a great family. I mean, that's sort of the short answer. I have a great supportive, loving, fun family, and I spend a lot of time with them when I'm not in the field. And I think that really helps keep me balanced. I have great friends who are very positive and insightful, and you know, and I have an incredible husband who also, I talk through things with people. You know, I don't bottle things up, and I think that's a very important part of processing trauma is to talk about it for me.
How do you get past the fear, and what makes you go back every time to do it again? I just can't even imagine living through something and going back and back and back.
Yeah. I mean, that's a hard question to answer. I wish there was like a way to turn it off. I can't. I feel a real responsibility to keep going back. I think there are so few people in the world who know how to cover war in with integrity and with empathy, and I think it's important to keep doing it because I believe that the work can actually make change. How do I deal with the fear? I am always scared. When people say you're fearless, it's absolutely wrong. I mean, before I was going to Yemen, I was terrified. I wasn't sure I would come back, and I think I have to talk about that fear to myself often. I have to sort of like say, okay, what are the real dangers? And am I scared because I have PTSD, which is post-traumatic stress disorder, residual trauma? Or am I scared because legitimately there is something to be scared of? And then I have to, I can talk to security advisors, which the New York Times has a great guy that we can sort of bounce stuff up off of. And that helps also in terms of figuring out, you know, how real is that fear? So a lot of it for me is sort of talking it through and figuring out if that has to do with my own trauma or if it's real and how to sort of navigate on the ground.
Can you please speak a little about your experience in Gaza, another region that our tax dollar is really hard at work?
I wasn't in Gaza at the height of the war. When I went, I was 27 weeks pregnant, and I covered the prisoner exchange. So obviously the situation in Gaza, it is completely cut off. Very little can get in or out. People can't, they have restricted medical care. They have restricted access to everything. And so I think I am definitely not an expert on Gaza nor on Israel-Palestine, because my philosophy is there are so many journalists that dedicate their lives specifically to that region, and I'm not one of them. So I just sort of, I've been in Gaza once, and I think the humanitarian situation there is criminal. But it's not my job to sort of, you know, I went in, I covered the prisoner exchange, and if I were working there more actively, then I would speak more about it, but I'm not.
With death over and over, and how does your family react knowing each time you step out that you are facing a potential returning in a casket?
I don't tell my family before I'm going somewhere generally. I kind of go, and when I'm on my way out, then I tell my family. So I don't want to make them worry. My husband obviously knows, and we talk through it. And we, you know, he challenges me and says, why do you have to go to Yemen? What can you contribute to the story? How safe is it? What is your plan? How are you? You know, he was a journalist for 16 years, so he knows very well that not everything is what it seems from the outside. So often, even in places like Yemen, the entire country is not being bombarded 24 hours a day. There's huge parts of the country where life is going on. People are at the markets. You can drive around. So, you know, the thing about war is that everything is unknown, and that is the real fear. And so I, you know, with him, I tell him everything and we talk about it. But with my sort of my parents and my sisters, I tend not to tell them.
Or, as a friend, you just get a text saying, hi, I'm in a boat in the middle of wherever, or in the middle of some country. And you're like, oh, how long have you been there for? You
know? Well, I then did, like, for Yemen, for example, I hadn't told any of my sisters, my parents. And so at some point on, like, the way in, I said, okay, I should tell one person, because if something happens to me, it shouldn't come completely out of the blue, and they should have one point person. So I told my sister Lisa, who's here tonight, and I said, you know, so every day we were on WhatsApp checking in. And so that's useful, because WhatsApp is a very useful tool when you're a journalist overseas, because it tends to work. It's very quick. And we just did daily check-ins. And I do that also with the New York Times security guards, because they need to make sure that we haven't been abducted. So we do a morning and an evening check-in.
And also, when you're sharing classified information, it is encrypted, so you cannot get access to it.
And how do I deal with death? I channel all of that into the work, and I, you know, it's the same as the pictures from Yemen. I'm a mother, and to see those children dying is devastating. But I, you know, I feel like it's important to be there. Our government needs to see and to be disgusted by what's happening there.
Is there a particular story or conflict that hasn't really been covered yet that you think needs to be and that you'd like
Yemen
to cover next?
Yeah. They're just starting to let journalists in. I mean, it took me Yemen. I mean, it took me 2 years to get permission to go. So, and most journalists are just starting to get in. So the Saudis have cut the airspace. So you can only fly into Aden, and the drive from Aden to the north to Sana'a, which is the place that's most devastated, the humanitarian crisis, it's an 11-hour drive through territory that there can be Al-Qaeda, there can be ISIS. And they know that.
The Saudis know that, so they don't let journalists let journalists fly directly into Sana'a because they don't want them covering what's happening there. Likewise, people in Sana'a and in northern Yemen who have terminal illnesses, there's no way for them to get out. They've cut the airspace. They're not allowed to fly out of the country for help. So they die.
In the past, you've written about when you were in Mexico, when you first started as a photojournalist, begging for some assignments.
Mm-hmm.
What would you say is the biggest thing that you've learned about yourself from that time until now that you didn't think you would know at that time?
I mean, I never thought I would actually be working consistently. You know, actually that fear never goes away. It's not like, you know, after every assignment, I sort of panic and think, oh my God, am I ever going to work again? Did I do it? Because it's just, you know, I feel very strongly that I need to sort of do justice to each story. And sometimes I'm tortured that I'm not doing it well enough. And so then I get scared that, you know, what if I'm just not doing a good enough job? And so that sort of same woman that was in Mexico struggling to get my first assignment, I'm the same person. You know, not that much has changed.
Other than you've told hundreds of stories that needed to be told that we needed to know about.
Yeah, but I mean, it's not, I think that it just, it's still important to like have that hunger, you know, it's important to never get arrogant because this job is not about the photographer, you know.
Next question. I'm just curious, in the last 2 years as a journalist, if you felt a big difference, like a tangible difference in the support and in the way the attitudes of the material that you're producing is being received?
I mean, that's a hard question for me because I don't live in America. I live in London. But I would say I think it's a very different climate now because we have a president who declares daily that journalists are the enemy of the people. And so he gives license to all the dictators around the world to kill journalists, disappear them, to lure them into their consulates and chop them up into pieces. I mean, I think, you know, when you say journalists are the enemy of the people, it's a very dangerous starting point, you know, because I myself have been abducted by a government that routinely said journalists are the enemy of the people, they're all spies and you should kill them. So it is, and unfortunately people believe him. And so I think the climate is really, really sad right now in America. I mean, we've seen a newsroom gunned down. You know, we've seen a journalist body checked, and we've seen the President of the United States basically celebrate that. So that's really sad.
Hi, thank you for being here. Your images are so powerful, and the stories that you tell, I mean, they're just phenomenal. Do you ever fear that the story gets lost with your images in the proliferation of how images are shared or how things are shared online through social media?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think that we are inundated every single day with images. You know, we're all on Instagram and we see pictures everywhere. But I don't really fear that, no. I think, you know, I work for very specific publications that, you know, it's not only about the photo, but it's also about the story that goes with it. It's a full package, and I work with some of the best correspondents in the world, and I feel very lucky because I know that whatever they're reporting is true and that they're not biased and that they're, you know. And so I think it's important to also, when you are being bombarded by a lot of images, to sort of curate your news source, because if you're looking for a pretty image, well, they're everywhere. But if you're looking for, you know, the truth about something, well, then you have to figure out who to follow and what news to read, because it's not, you know, when you see something on Twitter or Facebook or whatever, it doesn't mean it's true.
Thank you for that reminder. It's very true.
We have time for about two more questions.
I only ask this because of your stated sense of humor and because your sister's here. Were you a crazy person as a kid, too?
Lee, you want to answer that?
Well, she swam before she walked, so maybe, maybe that says something. I mean, she was always very active, kind of a pain in the ass, but yeah. I, you know.
Keeping it real. B.
The part of your story where you said you were driving up in the car with your female colleague and you're driving up and you're like, I can't do it. I'm a woman. I can't do it. I can't do it. And then you see her get out of the car and you're like, okay, I can do it. She can do it. I thought that was really cool. And I think it's really important to see, like, for, you know, girls and women to see other women doing this. So my question is, were there women photojournalists who inspired you to go into the field you are? And what would you say to young girls who want to be photojournalists and get into this?
I mean, it's so interesting because all of the war correspondents that were shown as, you know, sort of in the ICP and in all these places are all Robert Capa. They're all men, you know, but there were always women with them. Gerda Taro, Catherine Lerois. There are a lot of female war photographers that never got, that no one knows their names. And so, you know, for me, there were people sort of not very much older than me, women who were doing incredible work, like Carol Guzzi, Carolyn Cole, who was an LA Times photographer. She was very, very brave and a great photographer. But a lot of the people in this job are men, unfortunately, and a lot of white men. And I think, you know, we need to try and change that dynamic.
Thanks for being a part of the change.
Thank you.
Allowed is made possible by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, the Los Angeles County Arts Commission, the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, Cecilia and Jeffrey Glassman, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and individual Library Foundation members. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles.